Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, investors, and operators to learn about how we can build better climate tech companies and how we build more of them faster. On this episode, I talk to William Pelton, co-founder and CEO of Phytoform. Phytoform is a British climate tech startup that contributes to making agriculture more sustainable by helping to grow the next generation of future-proof crops. Phytoform makes minimal changes to plant DNA to grow crops that can feed the world's growing population in a sustainable manner. To find out how the underlying technology works, how it is different from controversial GMOs, and how to go about selling to the agriculture market, continue listening to William Pelton from Phytoform. Hey, Will, thank you so much for taking the time and being here. I know that you're a little bit sick, but I nonetheless hope that you're doing well. Are you looking forward to the weekend?
I am. I've only just started to come down with an illness, so looking forward to having that over the weekend. But thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, no, thank you for being here. Just to get started so that we get to know you a little better, I'd like to ask you about like what defines you as a person, apart from being a co-founder and CEO of Phytoform. So who are you outside work?
So I guess one of the things that is fairly unique about me is my passion for plants. So, you know, the company we've built, it's not just about being a founder and building technology. It's also sort of off the back of my passion for the way that plants work, how incredibly impactful they are for us as a society. And to be honest, just growing things is great, right? I'm a keen gardener. I now have a small garden in London, obviously. Has to be small, sadly. But yeah, that is a big passion for me on the weekends. Not right now. It's a bit wintry, but in the summer, yeah, that's where I am.
Are you part of the people who dream of having like their own farm at some point and just being like able to grow their own stuff and live self-sufficiently?
I am guilty of that a little bit. Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more realistic. That's not going to happen for some time. And also you have to live quite far in the countryside to be able to achieve that. But yeah, some part of me wants that good life.
Yeah. Oh, I can relate to that. Cool. Before we get into the gist of things, I'd like to ask you one more question. That is, like, just generally thinking about your life, your work, and so on, what is like the last aha moment you have had when you were like, oh, this is how things work?
I think the last aha moment for me, specifically about the company, was probably like we've been building the company for the last sort of 4 to 5 years, and recently, you know, we've been developing the commercial side of the company more heavily and starting to like scale up those commercials. And being in the biotechnology space, one of the most fascinating things that I think I realized and was like, aha, that's really interesting, was understanding like growers and farmers and understanding how innovative they can be, but at the same time, the pressure on them to deliver year on year, right? They get one shot usually per year at growing something, usually at scale. And so there's a lot of pressure on them to deliver on that. And realizing that actually the cultural change in agriculture, that there has been a cultural change occurring in agriculture over the last sort of 50 to 60 years. And it's a really interesting change. And we've basically been moving away from seeing like seeds and genetics as like a commodity and potentially not really worth a huge amount, there's not a huge amount of value, to realizing it's basically the center of our agricultural industry. Like genetics are really the pivot point for everything that we do in that space. And I think, yeah, the aha moment for me, long-winded explanation, was realizing that farmers, they understand that completely. Like growers get that completely, and they are completely willing to share value if you create real value using genetics. And that was kind of a big aha moment.
Sounds amazing. So many questions I could already ask about that, but let's let's start from the beginning. And just to introduce you a bit more, I'd like to talk to you about Phytoform today, the firm that you have started, but also a bit about your journey from as a scientist, gun founder, and the various, let's say, aha, hell yeah, and maybe also sometimes oh fuck moments that you have had on that journey. And when I was introduced to you, that was an intro made by Hampus Jakobsen, who was on the podcast before as well. He said that I would have to think about Phytoform as a ChatGPT for crops. How happy are you with this kind of evaluation of what you do?
I think it kind of depends how technical you are, but yeah, I would say that's a very high level way of describing the company. Very high level.
Okay, then let's try to start simple. How would you explain what you do at Phytoform to like a 12-year-old child? And then we can take it from there.
Yeah, so at Phytoform, our entire focus is on making seeds better, right? So basically taking the basic unit of genetics in plants, which is the seed, and improving it. And we improve seeds to make crops more resilient against climate, so the current impacts of climate. Also make them more efficient and less wasteful, so try to reduce waste during the growing period and also post-harvest as well. And we do that using a couple of tools. So one of them being artificial intelligence. And so we use artificial intelligence to basically understand the genetic language of plants and come up with solutions. And then we use a technology called CRISPR genome editing to take those solutions and introduce them into the seed.
Okay. And could you like paint a picture for me, first of all, of maybe what the agricultural sector looks like today, and especially the problem that exists today, and then compare that with a world where you as Phytoform have kind of achieved your mission. So kind of looking at the problem that exists today and then looking at a world where, well, you've solved the problem that you want to solve, right?
Right, yeah, big vision. So I think when we look at the industry today, I think it's important to look at the kind of ancient history of agriculture. And kind of effectively, for the last, 10,000 or well, I guess 9,900 years, agriculture has pretty much been the same, right? Maybe we've, developed better plows and we use metal instead of wood in some contexts, but pretty much it's been the same. Right? We haven't had access to genetics or chemistry or mechanization to improve agriculture. We've just been relying on, kind of what was natural and some trial and error. And that didn't do us particularly well. I think if you look at human history, it's been punctuated fairly regularly by famines, amongst other things. So although, agriculture was pivotal in how our society developed, it's also been one of the main challenges for society. That changed really around 60 to 50 years ago when we started introducing new chemistries, mechanization, and genetics into the system. And that was what we call the Green Revolution. And so one of the famous figures from that is Norman Borlaug, who was an American crop breeder. And he basically understood that we could use genetics to massively improve the efficiency of the system, coupled with the use of synthetic fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and of course, big tractors, amongst other machinery. And that was like a huge change for our agricultural system, right? We massively increased yields. I mean, the yield data is incredible. And at the same time, I think one of the important things is we also improved the consistency and resiliency of the system. But I guess the question is, at what cost? So, we're applying fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. We're using mechanization, creating like massive monocultures. And obviously now we understand that there is a cost to that. So we've been damaging soil, using vast amounts of energy to produce these fertilizers and chemistries, and obviously run the tractors. And so in some ways it's become incredibly efficient, whilst also silently becoming very inefficient. And so I think that's where we are today. And the problem is we've been lured into thinking it's a really robust system. And when you throw in climate change, you realize that that's not the case. Climate change is having this massive effect on agricultural systems worldwide, and it's not in a good way. So that's where we are now. And at Phytoform, fundamentally, we believe that you can no longer just keep adding fertilizers, right? There's a finite amount of fertilizer you can add onto a field before it's just being washed off and not being used. So that's not really the answer. Of course, we can try and find new herbicides and pesticides, and I believe that's important. But it's a bit like antibiotic resistance, right? We're slowly running out of various chemistries. Either they're being taken off the market because of toxicity, or weeds are just becoming immune to them. And mechanization, I mean, you know, we can't just keep making bigger tractors, right? They're already massive. So really, I think one of the key solutions to being able to improve our food system, our agricultural system, is genetics. Genetics is like this vast possibility, vast opportunity of vast potential. And it's something that we haven't really tapped into, right? We have spent a lot of time understanding genetics, but it's still fairly limited. And that's where Phytoform comes in. And what we want to offer is the ability to develop and scale genetic solutions across a wide variety of crops, across a wide variety of traits, and to solve a lot of the, basically biological problems that we currently throw chemistry and mechanization at to solve. Because biology is very efficient at solving problems when you sort of guide it. So that's really where we see the industry going. We want to use more biology, more crop genetics to solve some of the biggest problems.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And as you were saying now that, you know, genetics have not been used enough. I mean, we've all been aware of like the various, like say, controversials around GMOs, so genetically manipulated organisms, if that's the right...
genetically modified, but yeah.
Modified, exactly, modified. Sorry about that. But I understand, at least from reading up on what you do, that actually what you're doing is not classified as a GMO, or your products are not classified as a GMO. So could you maybe put the two things apart for me, like separate them for me, and then, you know, like highlight what are the advantages and disadvantages?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a bit of a complicated answer because what we do...
That's all right. That's what we're here for, to simplify this.
Good. So what we do is not considered GMO in many jurisdictions, so many countries. But in some countries, it still is. And one particular jurisdiction hasn't really made their mind up on this is Europe. So unfortunately, what we do in Europe is still currently considered as a GMO, but all biotechnologies are effectively. So rather than interrogate that in a bit more detail, Europe was like, nah, we're just going to, you know, blanket regulate everything in the same way. That might be changing. There is good news on the horizon. But for now, that's kind of the situation. But in many other countries, the UK, USA, Canada, much of South America, Japan, Australia, they've decided to regulate genome editing in a different way. So just to, I guess, frame the differences between what I consider are the differences between GMOs and genome editing. I think GMOs are kind of quite a blunt tool, right? You're taking genetics from other species, sometimes completely different organisms, right? So you're taking genes from like bacteria and then introducing them into crops. Now, I'm not actually against GMOs. I think in some contexts, they're a fantastic tool. But obviously, it does. It is a topic that people are very passionate about, quite controversial. But genome editing is kind of a whole new layer where instead of leveraging genetics from other species, we're leveraging the plant's own genetics because there is an enormous amount of opportunity locked up in every single crop, every single plant. And so, really, we're augmenting what already happens with conventional breeding, basically where you take two plants, you cross them, they have offspring, and you hope the offspring are better than the parents. It's, you know, natural cycle of things. And we're using our technology as a layer on top of that to basically accelerate that process. So we're just using the genetics that's already in the plant and tweaking it to accelerate the process of improving that crop.
Okay, and so how precise is so like just to summarize this also as someone who is not from a technical background, right? So the main difference that I understand now is that GMOs are really about introducing, if that's the right terminology, new strings of DNA that are not necessarily from that organism.
Exactly.
So like while gene editing is really taking the material that's already there and making certain traits that are maybe already there, for example, stronger or weaker, for example, is that kind of a way to summarize it?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good summary. It's a bit like if we look at it from the viewpoint of a book, GMOs are basically where you're shoving in new pages into a book that aren't necessarily like in context, but they do add information.
They're not related to the story. It's like crossing Harry Potter with Star Wars, more or less.
Yeah, or like, you know, adding a page in that has relevance to Harry Potter, but it you know, it's not in the right place and it's a bit out of context. Whereas genome editing is like us editing paragraphs of that book to maybe change the meaning of that paragraph, turn it from negative to positive, or change some characters' names around. So it does change the book, but not in such a radical way.
Yeah, and how precise is that? Like, maybe you can speak more to the, let's say, to your product, actually. So to this machine learning platform that I understand is like that, you know, core product, so to speak, or at the core of what you do, right? Would be great to hear also about like how precise is our understanding of a plant's DNA actually, so that we can edit it.
Yeah, so I mean, plant scientists have not been idle in the last sort of 100-200 years. They've been busy working to unravel the meaning of plant DNA, and of course DNA is DNA. So, you know, human DNA works in a very similar way to plant DNA. Not maybe the same like language, but still has the same basic unit. So it's like the difference between like, I don't know, English and German, right? Same, we use the same letters, but it is a different language. And there is a lot of similarity between it. Like I think German people can understand English people like partially and vice versa, but it's not exactly the same. And so scientists have done a huge amount of work to unravel that in plants. But I guess the challenge with plants is that it is like a multi-species problem, right? Like human medicine, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not not diminishing what people do in humans, but it is one species. And although this is not popular to remember, but we are actually quite inbred species. So we actually have quite similar genomes. Whereas plants, you know, we're growing bananas, we're growing rice. They're like extremely different in their DNA, in obviously their physiology, like what they look like. So it's much more of a challenge, right? We're trying to understand maybe hundreds to thousands of species that are quite different from each other. So it's a difficult problem, but scientists have been making like great inroads into this. But I think there's still a lot of information to be mined. And I think that's really where AI is like an incredibly useful tool, right? What is ChatGPT great at doing? It's great at using vast amounts of text data to then start to create or derive meaning and then create like new text. And DNA is just text, right? It's made up of four letters of code. That's it. In different sequences, different variations, but it is just text data. So we can apply similar solutions to ChatGPT. Not exactly the same, although Hampus would you say that? but similar solutions to plant data and start to extract real meaning and start to understand, I guess, some of the fundamentals of like how plant DNA works and what that language is, I guess. And then, of course, go a step further than that and start to use our AI to tweak the genetics to change the meaning in a subtle way.
Yeah.
So really how our machine learning works.
Yeah. And are you able to then basically project how the changes that you make to the DNA, right, will unfold once that plant has been, you know, actually grown, once it is on a field?
Yeah. Yeah. So depending on what and how you're working on plant DNA, you can predict that pretty accurately to a greater or lesser extent. So our particular focus in our company is on understanding gene activity. So I'm sure you're aware that in every cell in your body, you have the same set of genetic instructions. But clearly, the way those genetic instructions are read or how on or off individual instructions are differs. Otherwise, you'd just be like a blob, right? You'd just be one amorphous ball of cells. But you're not. You have eyes and skin and hair and all sorts of different tissues and organs. And that's all based on gene activity. So when certain genes are on or off. And it's the same in plants. So it's like fundamental to our development, fundamental to how we function. And that's what we focus on in plants.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. I mean, that sounds actually fantastic if our understanding is that clear and you can make your modifications that that precisely. I would like to maybe not confront you, but hear your opinion on an argument that is out there, and that is maybe actually more tailored to GMOs versus what you are doing. But I think it would also help to set the two things apart again. And I don't know if you've heard of Nassim Taleb. He's like an American mathematician, economist, philosopher, so to speak, author, and best known probably for his book Skin in the Game. So,
okay.
And he, in his books, he usually references a lot of mathematical theories to kind of explain different problems in life and why a lot of our, let's say, perceptions of life are maybe not right, why our intuition is often wrong. And he also writes about complexity theory, for example, and why he is against GMOs because of complexity theory. And his core argument is essentially that DNA is so complex that we can not possibly gauge like the implications of inserting like a new like element into DNA because it relates to so many different factors in that whole complex field, basically. If I understand him right, again, like I have no idea about, you know, genetics. So that's why I'm asking you as the expert here. And then I would like to hear your opinion on that, like how, yeah, let's say, well-reasoned that actually is, but also maybe then contrast that again with what you do.
Yeah, okay. So I agree, like DNA is extremely complex, no doubt. But I think we can break that complexity down like fairly effectively. And yeah, it's always hard to predict with complete certainty the outcomes of what you do. But at the same time, plants and biology is really robust. So I think it's really hard to completely change the state of a system with like individual changes. And I think you can demonstrate that pretty effectively when you look at conventional plant breeding. So what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years, we get to different plants, cross them, get offspring. And we've been doing that blind, right? So we have no idea. We didn't even understand DNA or that it existed, right? And we've just been doing it through trial and error. And yeah, the number of people that have been, I guess, affected in terms of health by, plants being crossed is pretty minimal, right? It's not often you hear about people being poisoned because some new variety of plant or crop has accidentally poisoned them. So I think the really far negative outcomes are extremely rare. And if you went with that kind of complexity argument, we'd basically just have to stop playing with plants, right, completely. Because conventional breeding is no different to GMOs in that respect. Like we're sort of tinkering with complexity, probably at an even greater level, right? Because you're dealing with like whole plant genomes. So understanding the outcomes is even more difficult.
Mm.
So I understand where they're coming from, but I think the likelihood of the extreme negative outcomes is very, very low, like just absolutely tiny. And the fact is, whilst that's interesting to say, we are experiencing a lot of real world pressure on our system.
Mm.
So conventional breeding is what we've relied on. And the fact is time is just running out using that sort of technique. The timelines for that kind of process are decades. So really long timelines. And when we're thinking about climate change, that's not even particularly relevant, right? We're thinking, how can we improve crops for the next 5 years, the next 10 years, not like 20 years from now. Things will have changed far too much by then anyway. So I think, we need these sorts of tools that can help accelerate this process. I think, of course, the other thing is, people don't take new varieties of crop and immediately scale it and immediately start selling it into the food system or putting it into the food system. There are a lot of different checks and balances in place along that whole process. So I understand the sentiment, but I think in the real world, it's just doesn't really fit. And the point is that the system is really robust anyway against those sort of issues. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I just wanted to give you some more time to reflect in case there was anything else coming. But that makes a lot of sense to me. And I just like to, it's very popular these days that people from outside of a discipline try to, apply outside knowledge to, a certain discipline, like let's say plant science, for example. And then, because they maybe simplify certain aspects of it, it's a lot easier to understand for a lot of people that all of a sudden this opinion carries a lot more weight than it maybe should. So I like to, you know, sometimes get someone else's opinion on these kind of arguments. As we have talked now about what Phytoform does and what you do and the impact that you hope to achieve, I'd like to also talk to you about a bit about the journey that you yourself have undergone and what steps led you to founding Phytoform and how you developed as a manager, founder, human being, let's put it this way. So could you tell me a bit about like the research that you did that led up to founding Phytoform?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So as I said at the beginning, one of my greatest passions in life is plants. Initially started off more on the kind of practical side, like growing them. But as I started moving into more of a research setting, obviously our passion became more and more focused on particular aspects of plant science. And genetics is something that's always fascinated me. I think we've seen such an incredible step change in our ability to read DNA in the last 10 years, right? The human genome is always a great example. It used to cost millions to sequence a human. Now it costs less than $1,000, maybe even less than that. So, really impressive reduction in cost and improvement in accuracy. And that has had way more of an impact in crops, because suddenly we've been able to unlock these massive genomes. Like plants are really, they have a lot of genetic data compared to a human. So, the largest genome in the world used to be Christmas trees, which is crazy. So that used to be the world record holder. I think it was about 15 times the size of a human genome. And more recently, this little plant, I can't remember what it's called. I'll have to look it up afterwards. But it's a plant from Japan, and it's like a little ornamental plant, right? Like a little white flower that you'd see in your garden. It's 150 times the size of a human genome. Why? I don't know. But the point is, there's a lot of genome to read, and new technologies have unlocked that ability. So beforehand, it just wasn't even possible. Now it is. So yeah, genetics has become a fascinating field to be in, particularly in crops.
Yeah.
So that kind of guided me through the research career, and then I think as I evolved in my career, I increasingly wanted to develop or work on problems that related to real world situations that had practical outcomes. And so for my doctorate, I actually focused on potatoes. So that was what the crop that I was working on. We're all familiar with potatoes. I know in Germany, big fans of potatoes. Same in the UK.
We're very fond of them.
they're a great crop, very high yielding and really tasty. So yeah, great one to work on. And working on potatoes for my doctorate and being part of an academic consortium, so of industry and other universities, I realized that there are definitely more efficient ways of translating technology into industry. And that wasn't necessarily the place of academic research, right? That's not necessarily what they're there for. So at the time, I was sitting next to my co-founder in our little doctorate desks in the kind of sweatshop that is PhDs and institutions. I think we just spent a lot of time talking about how we could apply some of the technologies we're working on, particularly CRISPR-based genome editing, and how we could do so more efficiently and what we could tackle. And we had one opportunity that I think was really important. So we were allowed to take part in this kind of internal program at Imperial College London, which is where we did our doctorates. And it was called the Lean Launchpad. You've heard of it? Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. It's company building methodology where it's very much understanding the customer's needs and then developing products to fit those needs. And we did that for 3 months, and it was transformative, right? We were forced to go and speak to actual customers, speak to the people in the industry, which for a doctorate candidate was for a PhD student, kind of different. Don't usually interact with industry that closely. And we spoke to hundreds of people across, hundreds of companies. And it was, transformative experience and helped us to understand exactly how we could use this technology in a way that had real world impact, improved the sustainability of ag, but also served the needs of our customers as well. And so I think that was the pivotal moment for myself, my co-founder, and building Fighterform.
Yeah. I'm wondering right now, do you have any advice on like how to rationalize this process of, you know, transforming your research into a business? Because I think there are so many very smart people out there working on potentially, you know, life-changing technologies, more or less, who stick to the research rather than maybe turning their research into a company. So like what maybe personal questions did you struggle with, or like what kind of advice or support were you really happiest about to be able to take that step of turning your research into a company?
Yeah, I think that the really difficult part, I think, transitioning from being more like a research, having a research career to, you know, starting a company, is understanding the true value that your technology could bring, a customer or the industry as a whole, and then understanding how to communicate that as well. Because you see fantastically intelligent people like butchering explanations of how their technology could be transformative, and being able to really clarify those ideas and be able to communicate them well, I think is really important and sometimes quite difficult skill.
Is that something that you had to practice and learn a lot, or like were you natural?
Yes. No, I was not a natural. I had to practice a lot. I think one of the great things about being in like a city like London, I'm sure it's the same in Berlin, is you have plenty of opportunities to practice that. So I think, you know, throwing yourself into these pitching competitions to really like hone that skill, hone your pitch deck is just incredibly important, right? It's like, you know, really rapid evolution of your company and how you present it. I think that was really important, having those opportunities.
Yeah. So you just say practice, putting your complicated research into very simple terms, like being able to make an analogy about Harry Potter and Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. Which I have to say, Hampus Jakobsen from Pebbly.io is amazing at doing. He's been really helpful in guiding us on that journey. But just take as much opportunity to put yourself out there, put everything like on the line, and pitch your company an idea.
Yeah. And then about the whole aspect of commercialization, right? So you said that, well, you had to talk to literally hundreds of people to find out who's actually at the bottom line, benefiting from your solution, right? So could you explain to me who are actually the people who will apply your solution? I mean, you already mentioned them earlier, right? So, speak a bit about like the innovation in that space, how people will deploy your solution, and how it impacts like the agricultural sector.
Sure.
And also like how you arrived at that point, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's a really important part of our journey. When you look at the agricultural industry, it is fairly complicated, right? There's lots of different crops that people are growing for lots of different reasons, use cases, many different supply chains. From the outside, it looks like this sort of industrial behemoth that's really hard to unwrap. And for us, during that kind of period where we were talking to customers, one of the most important pieces was developing the business model. And there's really like two routes you can go down, right? You can pick one crop, focus on that, and like vertically integrate along that supply chain. So you can like push your technology through. So you can go that vertical route or go the horizontal route. You know, so where you develop a platform and apply that technology to many different species, many different supply chains within those species of crop. And I think the first option is always the most tempting. And we've seen many different companies go down that route. And it's a tough one, right? Like at the end of the day, the genetic advantage you bring might well be lost later down the supply chain, right? Like, you know, genetics doesn't necessarily improve like how efficiently you can determine where trucks should go to deliver seed, right? That's outside what genetics can solve. And the second route, going this horizontal path, I think has been really difficult, because a lot of the technologies, like GMOs, for instance, have been incredibly expensive to develop. So I think, you know, when you look at some of the herbicide traits that Monsanto developed, you know, it's hundreds of millions of US dollars. That's not just the development, that also includes like the regulatory side of it, but, you know, really expensive. And you can see applying that to like multiple different crop verticals is difficult. And I think that's where tools like CRISPR genome editing have really changed the game, because they are far more accessible. Still not easy to use. I would like to caveat that. It's not as simple as, you know, buying a kit and applying it, but it's definitely far less capital intensive than those kind of earlier technologies. So yeah, being able to develop that horizontal business model was an incredibly important part of the journey, and talking to people in the industry, understanding exactly how we could apply that within each of these verticals, and also start to apply it cross verticals, so develop traits that are universal in some way, like need to be applied to multiple different crops, was incredibly important part of the journey.
Yeah, and so how do you deploy your solution now, right? Like, you went the horizontal way, and how do you deploy it? Who are the people who actually have like a bottom line benefit, right? And how is your solution reflected throughout the value chain?
Yeah, so as I said, going that horizontal route meant that our best like access to the market was through these kind of genetic gatekeepers. So there's kind of two categories I always think of. There's the seed companies, so like your classic seed companies, for example, you know, some of the big ones like Syngenta, Bayer, Lima Grass. But then there's also a second category of like vertically integrated food processors. So, for example, Kraft Heinz still has a tomato seed company, interestingly. So they obviously, you know, have a vested interest in ensuring the highest quality of supply of their raw materials. And so they actually invest in improving the genetics of those raw materials. So those are kind of the two partners we work with. And of course, I think that the real value to Phytoform is we can access like the best crops, right? We can access like the elite, is how they describe them, the elite lines of, you know, whatever it is, tomatoes, potatoes, some of the crops we're working on, through our partners, and then provide them, create that added value with our traits. And then, of course, we have this incredible vehicle with which to then distribute those traits and get them, scale them up into the marketplace. It's like starting with an amazing car and then just like improving its efficiency or speed further using our technology.
Yeah. And how can I imagine it? Like, do you like give a like Heinz company, for example, access to the genetic data basically so that they know how to like breed a new seed, or what is the overlap here? You know what I mean? Like, what kind of product is being exchanged? You know what I mean?
What we deliver them at the end of the day. So we kind of offer the like full stack. So they will come to us with a problem. So, you know, for tomato, you know, drought is a great example. Processing tomatoes for, you know, ketchup and pasta sauce are mostly grown in Mediterranean regions around the world. So California, the Mediterranean in Europe, Australia. And of course, they are experiencing, more and more regular droughts that are more and more extreme in how negative they are. So they will come to us with the problem of drought, and then they will also provide us with their genetics, their like best tomato variety, whatever it is, Kraft Heinz 182 or something. I don't know what it's called. And we will take their genetics. We will effectively translate the language of their plant's DNA, use that with our machine learning to then create a solution. Use our editing to take that solution from the computer and into the real world. And then we deliver them seeds with the trait added in. So yeah, it's kind of, that's why I say full stack. I don't know if that's the right way of describing it, but like, you know, at the end of the day, they get their variety back, but with our improvement.
Got it. Sorry, I have to ask, what kind of, and just give me a range. Just like, what kind of price range is your product placed then? Because I mean, like, agriculture is huge. These companies are huge. So I'd be interested in, you know, like, what kind of numbers are we talking about?
Yeah. So one of the things that I really like about agriculture is the kind of prevailing business model in this space, which is also revenue model, which is based on royalties. So if you develop a trait, you add value. Usually there's obviously some upfront costs that are covered, but the majority of that value is then accrued during the commercialization and scaling of that product. And I think it aligns incentives fantastically, right? Because our partners don't have to pay us huge amounts until we are having huge impact in the field. And vice versa, if things don't work out, they're not incurring like a massive cost. So when you look at some of the existing biotechnology traits, you know, they're massive, right? Hundreds of millions, if not like billions of dollars a year, because they add so much value, you know, basically growers just cannot do without them. They're so pivotal. And that's kind of the route we plan to go down, right? We want to add serious value, increase yields, decrease inputs like fertilizers and the amount of energy needed. And in that way, share the value with our partners and with the rest of the supply chain.
Yeah. As we're slowly but surely coming to an end, I'd like to ask you a question that I have kind of taken from Hampus again, and he basically told me that the best founders he's looking for are the ones that start out as pirates and, you know, kind of start out with a sort of makeshift skipper, so kind of taping stuff together, right?
Yeah.
But who have the ability or potential to grow into Navy admirals, right? So who are able to scale and then actually, you know, grow more organized and so on and so forth. So, I mean, you said you have been building the company for a while now. You're roughly like around 30-ish people, like, right?
20, like 20 people.
20-ish people. So how have you, when you look at your evolution as, say, as a manager and founder, what have been like your main learning, so to speak, you know, like what have you learned about yourself?
So I think the first thing is, you know, I'm a technical founder, and I think sometimes technical founders get a bit of flack, right? You know, less experience on the business side. But I think one of the key things about being, or the key advantages of being a technical founder, is you are seriously willing to learn and really like grab the bull by its horns, right? So, yeah, I think coming in with like a really open mind, and that sort of, I don't know, hunger for learning has been a really important part of the journey. And I think that's like a key prerequisite for any founder, right? I think that's pretty obvious, but yeah, it's definitely the case. In terms of myself, I think, yeah, just the like understanding like how resilient you need to be, like how far you can push yourself has been, yeah, an interesting part of the journey. Like, it's not easy. I don't think anybody thinks it is. And so having that kind of determination, that resilience is just so critical.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Having a co-founder helps as well, right? I can't imagine doing this on your own. Must be incredible.
No, that sounds great. Well, I wish you all the best for that journey that lies ahead of you. I hope that you have that Admiral's hat on at some point. And yeah, otherwise, say Hampus, say hi to Hampus for me, because, well, we have talked about him way too much, more than we should, so...
Yeah, he gets a lot of PR for free. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me on. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, and, likewise.
Look forward to speaking soon.
Yeah, exactly. Bye, Will.
All right. Take care.